Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you're a returning subscriber, welcome. I hope you're having an amazing day. I hope all of your dreams are coming true. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts and join this community. You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. So hit that subscribe button. I am here with the man, Dr. David Bozzetta. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Nick. It's a real pleasure and honor to be with you today.
So we had such an awesome pre-show, you and I, when we were planning and just kind of connecting on what we were going to talk about. I almost wish we recorded that, but you have such an amazing story. The perils of the journey that you have been on have been, I was telling my wife about them after we spoke that day. And you have some really cool research that I think our ethics and compliance and human resource folks who are really trying to give a voice to the voiceless in their organizations I think your story is really going to resonate with them. So why don't we just dive in and you can just kind of start telling us this story of how you almost upended one of the biggest companies in the world with what you saw and what you found.
That's great. And please, any questions, just interrupt me as we're going through it. I agree with you. Our informal chat the other day was absolutely wonderful. So we'll try to replicate that now.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty simple story. It's not unique in the sense that it's happened to many other individuals in corporate America, around the world, as a matter of fact. But I think what's unique about the story is that it has three pieces to it. It's the event itself, what happened subsequent to the event, and what has happened since then in terms of paying it forward. And if we take a look at those three pieces, I think we can begin to understand first and foremost that there is life after whistleblowing. One of the most devastating, crushing bewilderments of my life occurred on January the 14th, 2004. And I was told after 21 years at Chrysler that my services were no longer needed and changes were being made. And there was obviously more to that story. So after being escorted out of the building, I immediately picked up the phone, called a team of lawyers who specialized in employment law and told them my story. And the story goes something like this. I was 21 years at Chrysler, third generation. My grandfather, my father worked at Chrysler, and I was very proud to work there, started as a management and trainee. Rose very quickly through the ranks. I accepted every opportunity that was provided to me, and I had an insatiable appetite to find out more about than just building cars. I wanted to know how they were built. My background was entirely finance, undergraduate, graduate degree in finance, but I always wanted to have that link to operations. I wanted to have some value. I didn't want to sit and just prepare spreadsheets and forecast. I wanted to actually go to look at the machines that were being requested to be purchased and things like that. So spent a number of years traveling around the country, implementing process costing, process management, small team of us, phenomenal opportunity. Got to see A to Z in terms of the car industry, from foundries to stamping plants to engine plants, absolutely priceless education. And along the way, I got to understand some of the inner workings. And with that experience, I was promoted to the head of North American Operations Audit. This was right after the merger of equals between Daimler and Chrysler. And so I was promoted to the head of audit, and it was at that time that I started to really see some things that needed to be called out, and as having the responsibility to do just that. I thought that was what I was put there to do. So time after time, a number of events. Started out not really on the grand scale, but definitely ended up on a egregious, illegal, immoral, corrupt scale that I had absolutely no choice, as far as I was concerned, but to bring that forward. And it culminated in a meeting overseas where the presentation was made in terms of the special accounts that were used to ease the import of vehicles into foreign countries. With these special accounts, they were used to bribe government officials and change the length of time that vehicles were brought into countries from typically 2, 3, 4 weeks or more to 2 days in some cases. So it was literally over the blink of an eye. Obviously gave a competitive advantage at that time to Mercedes-Benz in those vehicles. But being listed on the New York Stock Exchange after the acquisition, my question was, what are we going to do to get rid of these accounts? And it was at that time, boy, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. And I knew at that time that I had crossed the line, at least in their eyes, that I probably shouldn't have, but gave me the wherewithal to bring that information back to the United States and pass it on to the appropriate individuals at that time.
So when you saw these accounts, you saw it before the meeting, obviously. Were those rooted on the Daimler side?
Yeah, entirely.
Yeah. So how, I mean, this is always an interesting thing because up until I think a couple of years ago, like you could take tax deductions in Germany for like bribes. So was this a sort of a smashing together of cultures that, you know, this behavior that was apparently kind of acceptable in that jurisdiction that, you know, kind of in conflict with the new regime, the new sort of combined regime, merger of equals, as you say. How do you, like, that's always such an interesting, It's a kind of an interesting thing to like navigate through. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look, had there not been a merger, had there not been a stock symbol DCX on the New York Stock Exchange, no harm, no foul, right?
Right.
Once it was listed on the New York Stock Exchange, now suddenly you have all the SEC regulations.
Right.
You have Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and things like that. And under that umbrella is where all of that fell. And this is just one example, the most egregious example, though. And so began to work with the SEC and the Department of Justice in terms of providing them the information that I had, and took a number of years, but eventually with extensive investigation on their part, the Daimler Chrysler at that time had penalties and fines imposed upon them that totaled $189 million. At that time, it was the sixth highest penalty. At that time, again, going back a number of years, there's been far greater ones since then. But you know, it set me aside from everyone else, including dozens of predecessors in that job that I had. And, you know, I explain it this way, Nick, I didn't have a lot of time to react. I knew something wasn't right. And it wasn't like, okay, well, let me think about this for a while and I'll decide what I'm going to do. It was an instantaneous reaction. I knew exactly what I was going to do. I was going to take it forward. I was going to say it wasn't the right thing to do. And when was this going to be eliminated? I had an immediate target on my head, and I was threatened. My family was threatened. They made life very, very difficult for me for about 3 years until the termination finally took place, and that took place coincidentally 5 days after the CFO in the United States had retired. So it wasn't a coincidence, really. But yeah, it was a life-changing event, and one that when it happened, I thought my world had ended. Yeah.
So I want to dive into this. So
yeah,
you saw this thing, you looked at these accounts, and you're like, what's going on with these accounts? I don't really understand sort of, I hear what you're saying at a high level. I don't understand what the implication of these accounts were and how they actually worked, which we maybe don't need to get into. But either way, there was some gap between the light bulb turning on and you saying, okay, I need to bring this forward. And then your decision to bring it, like, was your decision to bring it up for the first time in that meeting? Or had you talked to the CFO or talked to other folks prior to the meeting? How reactionary was that for you? Or were you like, all right, today's the big day, when you were walking in for that thing?
No, it was immediate. It was during the presentation. I asked the question, what's the plan to get rid of these secret bank accounts? And all of a sudden they called for a break. And at the break, I was escorted over to area, and I was told, you shouldn't have asked that.
Wow.
Whatever you hear in these meetings stays in these meetings, and it's never to be repeated. All that did was put fuel on the fire for me.
Totally.
I took copious notes of everything that I had heard, and immediately after getting back to the United States the very next day, went into the CFO, the controller, and said, here's everything that I heard, verbatim, handwritten, here you go. And it was A to Z. So I felt at that time that was my responsibility.
Yeah,
I had upheld the fiduciary responsibility. I had it as the head of audit. I passed it on to the highest level financial individual in the organization. I was done. And I never really gave it much thought after that, until the threats, until the additional items start to pile on very, very quickly.
So how shocked were you when you brought it up and you could hear the pin drop?
I was floored. I thought I was asking a question that
normal,
had I not,
basic.
I was surprised no one else had their hand up after hearing that, immediately after hearing it. And then I knew that for some reason I was, everyone had taken a step back and I was the only one in the front of the line at that point.
Wow. So you're like, hey, this is what you do. This is, you're obviously a company man. You're a third generation guy in this business. You wanted to learn it inside and out. There's, it feels like it was a big, accomplishment or sort of a fulfillment of a dream to just be in this business and, being able to apply these skills and, these degrees that you've earned to the pursuit of this business and so forth. It feels like this was just the carrying out of what you felt your fiduciary duty was. Talk to me about that window of time between, the pin drop, on one end, and then the other end, when you finally get escorted out after your boss walks out. Talk to me about that buildup and how that felt as the threat started to come. I mean, you said, hey, I passed this over. I thought I was good to go. This will get worked out appropriately. Tell me about how it ended up turning into the fight and added what I would imagine is more sort of gunpowder to the powder keg that ended up driving, kind of that next stage of the conversation story.
So coming back, I still obviously had that role as the head of audit in North American operations. So I continued my job. I continued to go out to each and every location. I continued to find more and more examples. So here you had the one that was already on the shelf, as far as I was concerned, in terms of the secret bank accounts. I just went on then to do my job as the head of audit. And I would go out with every audit team. I would ask the questions. And there just seemed to be every stone that was unturned. There was many, many examples of things that just weren't right. And so I would collect those, go into a plant in Indiana, a brand new powertrain plant talking to the individuals, and all of a sudden they say, well, here's all the equipment that we have now, but that's not even half of what we have stored in the Air Force Base hangar.
So how crazy is that? I mean,
Air Force Base hangar.
Yeah. What account is that in? Right.
Yeah. So off we go. Pop in the minivan. I said, let's go take a peek. So we go there and slide open huge doors. And as far as you could see, just row after row after row of equipment. And it was equipment that was incorrect the first time it was ordered for the new plant. Take it away, get new stuff in there, and just put this other stuff, not on the books, just put this other stuff and we'll use it for parts in the Air Force Base hangar. Write up the audit report, turn in the audit report for review, and in front of me, it was ripped up.
So the point there is what was the implication of that hangar? It was a bunch of essentially losses that weren't booked?
Yeah, it was equipment that was not on the books, exactly. Yeah. And it was just being used as scrap as they needed it to fix the other machines and things like that. The point is it was off the books. And so I wrote the report up, had the report written up. I reviewed it. I said, yep, that's what we want to say. Passed it on up the chain of command for review. And it was ripped up saying it would never be published.
Amazing.
And so that happened time and time again.
So what I find kind of interesting is you... third generation guy, you came up in this business, you were presumably in doing audit stuff to even, you presumably have been doing a bunch of audit work to even have wound up in that meeting in Germany, right? Like you weren't like a low level guy doing, inventory counts or something. And yet it seems as if, so correct me if I'm wrong, it seems as if once that big stone was unturned, that was maybe even rooted on like the Daimler side, you started seeing a bunch of like corruption elsewhere within the Chrysler side.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think that was? Did you just have a new eye to look at things a little bit more closely? Or were you kind of questioning like, man, is this the whole thing rotted out or what? Like, talk to me about that.
Yeah, great question. And you know what? So that's how I went into the job. And I was greeted coming into the job by the individual that I was working for or about to work for. And the first thing he said was, you were not my pick for this job. You were put into this job.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, glad to be here.
Yeah. And, where's my desk? Right.
Yeah. And so back to your point, though, those were things that for decades prior, without people that had the same role and responsibility as I had, who never left the office, who never put boots on the ground, into those, who never had the lenses that I had from the previous experience traveling around the country, around the world in all these plants. It was a different set of lenses, but first and foremost priority was let's find those opportunities for improvement and expose them. And if we don't ever expose them and they stay under the rug forever, how is it ever going to change? How is it ever going to be fixed?
Yeah, how are you ever going to fix anything, right?
Absolutely. So it was just a different approach. I thought the right approach, and in my mind, the only approach I would ever take. I would never write something that was not true. I would to acquiesce to the pressure of, oh, that's too politically sensitive. We can't say that about that individual. And I said, well, I can't not say it. And so as each report was getting torn up, I was passing those on to the CFO and the controller who knew the real story. So at least I, again, in my mind, was not just letting them get torn up and say, okay, well, I tried. I had access to an individual at the highest level in the financial community within the organization to say, hey, psst, this is really, you'll never see this as a formal audit report, but this is the real audit report. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Oh, man. It's so wild. I don't think this is just the lens that I look at the world through. I don't think that Daimler Chrysler was some anomaly. This kind of stuff is probably going on all over the place, which means, assuming that there's a relatively sort of consistent level of smart people, right, who have gone to good business schools or have gone through the right training programs, that there are layers of these folks again, it's not like, well, everybody's just stupid. Like, there's smart people everywhere that are living in this kind of corruption and they're turning a blind eye to it. And it's just it's a fascinating thing because clearly there's a ton of like basic audit principles that are being violated for this kind of stuff to persist. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. And I would challenge you and to anyone else listening to this to think of an industry, think of an organization, think of a slice of the corporate pie that's immune to this. Think of a slice of society that's immune to this. You have medicine, you have doctors, you have priests, you have lawyers, mm-hmm. you have sports, athletes.
Right.
Every walk of life is typically has some tainted mark on the organization, on that part of society that has these types of examples. Right. And it's not that it's unique. It isn't in the last 3 or 4 years. Some of these QI-TAM laws originally put in for whistleblowers go all the way back to the Civil War. And it was experienced even back then. So corruption isn't unique. People's ability to say something or not say something is also not unique. And there's just a natural tendency, I think, for individuals to be fearful because of decades and decades of examples of what happens to individuals who do say, hey, question here. When are we going to get rid of those bank accounts?
Done.
There you go. All of a sudden, you got a lot of people say, oh, I'll never do that.
Yeah. So that 3 years, it was obviously ramped up to a boiling point when you're escorted out. Talk to me about how that boiling point felt. You know, what did that feel like? The living in fear, those 3 years of hell. Talk to me about the threats to your family. Like, that seems so far over a line. And you're like, I'm just talking about these bank accounts that I thought we're all trying to do because we're on the stock exchange. Like, we're subject to the FCPA. I thought our job was to extinguish these risks. And now you're threatening my family. Like, that's bizarre.
I think it became very apparent very quickly that I was an anomaly. I was told that I didn't fit the mold of corporate audit. Yeah. I was told that I was not a team player. I was told repeatedly that I was going to be fired. I was cast aside. I was put in to an office that was not even remotely similar to offices that predecessors at that level in the past had been afforded.
The proverbial Siberian outpost,
the broom closet. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And again, none of that mattered because here's what it boiled down to, Nick. It boiled down to the decisions that I made on a regular basis to do the right thing, to say the right thing, to say exactly what was going on, or acquiesce and succumb to the thumb that was consistently trying to be applied to me in general. And there was just no possibility of me allowing myself to be squashed by a thumb.
Pull me back to when you were a kid. Were you a guy that just didn't get pushed around when you were a kid?
You know, it's really interesting you bring that up because it's only been, say, within the last couple of years that I've drawn some real interesting correlations between what I did in my professional life and events that took place that I had not even thought about for years and years and years, running across an individual on a school bus. I should have never been on the bus. My car had broke down at the time. I was probably a junior in high school, never would have been caught dead on the bus, but I was there. And just witnessed some real abuse, verbal abuse to a young girl in the back, and you know, no one was sitting there with her, and I could have cared less. They came in, saw what was going on. I went right back and sat next to her, started to talk to her. I didn't even know who she was. Didn't even give it a second thought, but it stopped the abuse that was taking place. And same thing, we were traveling on a corporate event. We were actually in Istanbul, Turkey, and getting ready to fly back, a big group of us, and one individual from Canada was having trouble with his passport, and everyone else was just going through the line. And I had gone through the line, and I looked back and saw what was happening to him, and everyone else was going. I'm like, where's everybody going? He's still stuck back here.
So he's about to wind up in a Turkish prison, this guy.
Yeah. So I ended up staying back until that all got cleared up. And we actually missed that flight. We had to take another one, but again, never even gave it a second thought. And you know, I think that the way we're brought up, I think that the influence that we have on us, some of it we don't even realize that it's going on. But right. it gets embedded in our structure. And some of the research that I did after leaving Chrysler toward my doctorate degree pointed out the fact that these decisions that we make, they're not accidental.
Right.
They're rooted into and very strongly supported by an internal structure that some is inherited, but most of it is through teachings, learnings, decisions that we make, feedback from decisions that we make. And you can go through life being afraid and fall into an 80% category where, oh boy, I saw those secret bank, but I'm not saying a word. Or you could be 10% of the people who say, I'm out of here. I'm not going to open my mouth, but I don't want to work at this company. Or you raise your hand and say, hey, this isn't right. What are we going to do about it? And that's kind of the camp that I landed in.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, when I talk to people like you, the sort of proud whistleblowers, the principled people that they always have these kind of guardian stories where they've been a guardian for justice, or they've always been somebody who just cares a lot about justice and cares about injustice and rectifying those things on like a deep visceral level. And I find it interesting that you kind of say, you know, there might be some wiring in there, but it seems like you, David, fall on the side of the fence that would say, well, it's probably a lot more like nurture than nature. Yeah. It's a lot more nurture. It's a lot more feedback loops. It's a lot more reinforcement of inputs and stuff like that. I find that pretty interesting. And I don't know which side I fall in, which side of the fence I think I might fall more on the nature side. So I read this story about a study. This could have been real, or this could have been from a thriller novel. So it might even be fake. Yeah. But there was a study of students who grew up on a military base, and they had, you know, all the kids went to go see a movie, and the movie would, you know, they had like the infrared camera so they could see in the dark, and there was like a scary thing that happened. And like 90% of the kids would just jump and jump back, and a small portion of the kids would jump forward. And you can see some of these videos on YouTube, even if somebody pops out of a thing to scare somebody and somebody just throws a punch right off the bat. Most people jump back and kind of run. That is a very nurture or nature thing.
Yeah.
Like that kind of like knee jerk kind of like reflex. And what I find with a lot of these guardian whistleblowers, like foundational whistleblower folks like you, like just the fact you didn't make that connection to me, again, I'm no psychologist or doctor or anything, but like to me is an indication of like, you're just kind of wired that way. You're just wired to go sit by that girl on the bus. You were just wired to stop and miss the flight with this guy from Turkey. And you put that value over and above your personal comfort. I mean, again, it was probably better to get on the plane. It's probably better to not be delayed in freaking Istanbul. I'm sure you had a family to get back to. All that kind of stuff, right? Like most people, I think, are probably, if whether it's that middle of the bell 80% or the 10% that can just rationalize it, that are bothered by it but are rationalized by it, at some level they're putting their own comfort, their own sort of like utility, whatever you want to call it, above this injustice or this misapplication of justice that they're witnessing.
So now take what you said and now apply that to the decision that I made regarding my professional career and the decision that many people are forced to make.
Totally.
So here's what was in front of me, right? And I knew it. I absolutely knew what was going to happen. Two mortgages, $300,000-$400,000 a year in compensation with bonuses and things like that. Stock options, two daughters in college, everything. I was extremely fortunate and very thankful for everything that I had. I knew staying on the path that I was on, the being resolute to what I was committed to do, that would all be gone in a snap of a finger. And it was. It was. The minute I was escorted out, they said, well, we'll give you 1 month severance. 21 years of service, 1 month severance. That's when I said, let me call the legal team and they can talk to you. And so it disappeared. Everything disappeared. Stock options, bonuses, everything was frozen. And it disappeared. I didn't care.
I gave up
everything. I didn't care because what was the alternative? The alternative was, okay, you guys win. Nope. All right. Lips are sealed. Never saw it. Never happened. Do whatever you want to do. Just tell me what to write on these things. I'll sign my name and life will be good. Right. Sorry.
Well, I mean, it's so fascinating because again, just broad brushstrokes. Let's say that distribution you talked about is right. 10% are going to rationalize it and walk away. 80% in the middle are going to just go along to get along. 10% are going to say, I'm not standing for this.
Yeah.
90% rationalize it to some degree. They say what? They say, well, I'm not going to fight City Hall. You can't fight City Hall. The whole world's corrupt. What am I going to do? It is what it is. Yeah, it stinks. I'm just kind of thinking out loud, but like that probably, there was probably a similar distribution when slavery was prevalent in the South in the earlier part of our country. There's probably a bunch of people who thought like, yeah, this is kind of messed up, but people weren't willing to do anything about it. They were just, all right, well, this is how it is. And they just accept it or something. But there's massive injustice. I mean, think of Germany in the 40s and stuff. Like there's all these crazy things that happen and people are just like, well, I'm just going to go along to get along or whatever. It's just it's a bizarre thing. And thank God that there's that little group of folks that'll actually stand up for it and do something about it. But let me ask you, where do you think the battleground is? You know, where do you think the battle? So let's pull this into our companies, right? Like a lot of the folks who listen to this are in the ethics community. They're trying to drive these speak up cultures. They want a whole team of folks like you. And from my standpoint, as a business operator and as a business person, I love people like you, people who are willing to put the mission first and willing to speak up about something that's wrong, because I'm passionate about that. And I want everyone to have a great experience. I don't want us to have a business that's full of, you know, that's not based on integrity or something like that. But where do you think that battleground is? Is it influencing the 80? Is it influencing the other 10 that are just going to say, yeah, I'm going to just, you know, I see it, I don't like it, and I just can't be around it, but I'm just going to leave? Like, where do you think the battleground is? Is it making the 10% that your group of, you know, 12%, 15%, you know what I'm saying? Like, where do we push?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And I've done some research, actually published written a paper on the Ethical Learning Organization. And while I was at Chrysler, I had the great opportunity to work with Peter Senge out of MIT, Fred Kaufman at that time also out of MIT, and they were promoting and just starting up the concept of the learning organization. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I said, well, what if we put those two pieces together? What if we put ethics and created an ethical learning organization? Because you can have a learning organization, but if the people that are in the organization aren't ethical, then it's not going to work. So what if the organization had as part of not just the mission or the vision, but the day-to-day activities where from the maintenance people to the CEO, if had the ability and the confidence to know I can say anything I want without fear of retaliation, without fear of losing my job, right, wrong, or indifferent. I can raise my hand and say, hey, you know what? This is what I saw, or this is what we had. Now, that exists to a point when it comes to like safety, of course, and things like that. Of course, raise your hand. And if there's an issue that needs to be fixed there, but it's very rarely done on the ethics or morality yeah. side. You have compliance hotlines, of course, so you know all about that, but is that enough?
I don't know. And, you know, as you're just saying this, and as I'm talking with you, so the number one thing that everybody says, and I say it too, is the reason people don't speak up is fear of retaliation.
Yeah.
But more of the actual whistleblowers that I speak up or speak with and get to know, they don't care about the retaliation. So is it just a rationalization because most people, 90% of people are not that special 10% that you're a group of, that you're a part of and stuff like that? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, is that even the reason people don't speak up?
Well, I definitely think that's the reason that people don't speak up. I think it has everything to do with fear. And the number one fear is, I'm going to lose my job.
Yeah.
Without even a close second. Now, think about that for a minute. And you raised an interesting point because, including myself, and I had the opportunity to meet and stay in contact with many, many whistleblowers during my research. Sharon Watkins, Bradley Birkenfeld, Markopoulos, mm-hmm. You know, they everyone has fear of being retaliated against. I mean, it's not fun, but does it take the place of or override the thought that I would have to face myself in the mirror every single day saying, oh my God, I gave into it. I really didn't want to sign that audit report. I didn't want to make that transaction. They said it was only going to be for 1 month. They gave me a promotion and incentive for doing. Mm-hmm. No, at that point, you just have to say, I don't care what it is, including the fact that I am probably going to lose my job. I hope I don't, but if I do, I do, because that's not greater then the fear of that is greater than having to face myself and trying to convince the voice in my head that I really did the right thing when in fact I know I didn't. So this mental dissonance that's created is absolutely, to me, that I was more afraid of that.
Yeah. It's bigger than the fear of the retaliation, bigger than the yeah. fear of what is going to happen to my daughters in college and stuff like that. You know, something nobody ever talks about is how lonely, well, maybe everybody talks about this, I don't know, but it must feel like lonely to be a whistleblower who's willing to sort of burn it all down for this principle, assuming that these odds that you're talking about are the odds, like if this distribution is true and you have a family of five, then probably four of them are in the middle, the 80, one is in the first 10 and you're the other 10. So you have four other people that wouldn't have done what you did. And again, I don't know your family size or anything like that, but talk to me about like what that dynamic was like with your wife or with your kids or with your friends, even guys you went to, you know, grew up in the business with or something. Like people must have thought you were nuts.
Oh, the overwhelming majority of my colleagues at the time at Chrysler thought I was nuts.
Yeah.
And except for, and I could count them on one hand, probably on two or three fingers. They said, you know, you're nuts. Look what you're giving up. You're going to get fired. I would never do it. Are you out of your mind? Just go back and tell them you're sorry.
Wow.
And yeah. And so all of a sudden now in my mind, I'm drawing a line saying, okay, now I got these folks over here.
Yeah. You're part of the problem.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's a great word, lonely, because even walking down the halls and people start to talk and they know what's going on. They know what's being brewed up
totally.
Behind the curtain, right? And so they're pointing as you're walking down the halls. And after it did happen, there was probably 2-3 months where we couldn't even leave the house to wow. go to a restaurant or something. You know, somebody would see me and, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the questions and the press was hounding me. My oldest daughter worked as a editor of a newspaper at the time, and she would call at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, I'm looking at the AP wire service and there's something coming out today. and you're not going to like it. And
wow.
Yeah. However, I will tell you, Nick, without my two daughters and my wife, I would have been dead. They were my support. They were the foundation. I was at the lowest point of my life. I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do. No clue. And then, you know, my faith, my conviction that everything happens for a reason kicked into overdrive at that point. And with their help, we made it through it. To this day, some 15, 16, 17 years later, I can look back and say that was absolutely, absolutely the best day of my life.
Wow.
Without that happening, none of what has happened since then would have happened.
Right.
And I am so fortunate and so blessed to be where I am today. And I say it's a result of exactly that event, which further solidifies the fact that everything happens for a reason. Everything we do is predestined to take place, whether we like it or not, whether we understand it or not. And I am a living example of someone who has come out of the other side of blowing the whistle, and very thankful, would do it in a heartbeat again. Absolutely.
So if what you said in the beginning is true, and that most of who we are is not from the way that we're wired, but how we learn things and what the feedback loops are and the decisions we make and how our conscience gets sort of seared or not seared or whatever, if you think about you would have been a different person than you are right now had you not made the decision that you made. You would have been a different guy. You would have been a different, that decision, because you would be looking in the mirror every day knowing it. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to rationalize that, or you're going to, you know, do something drastic or something. I mean, it's pretty interesting. Like, you wouldn't just be who you are right now, just still working at Chrysler or something. Like, you would have been a different person, a different guy.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. I think of that very, very often. I would have most likely stayed there, right? I had no reason to leave.
What were you going to do? You got all those options, all that 401k.
Yeah, the golden handcuffs definitely were on and firmly secure. So I would have stayed there for 35, 40 years. I don't know. But I would have been going through the motions like so many of those colleagues that said, oh, you're out of your mind 17 years ago. What are you doing? And that's what ended up happening to many of them. You end up going through the motions. So that happened to me. I would have never, ever gotten the doctorate degree. I would have never done the research on whistleblowers. I would have never been able to publish work on that research, continue that work today as an adjunct professor at Northwood University. I treat every day as the best day ever, because that's exactly what it is. And I'm thankful for what happened in the past. I want to pay it forward going forward. And I treat every day as a gift.
So, you know, something you said really resonated with me, and you said, I've never regretted it. And something else you said is that there's life after whistleblowing. What would you tell people who are witnessing something and they're on the fence about whether they should raise their hand or not, or even the folks who have done it that are in the bottom, you know, they're in that valley of death right now, and they don't see any light at the end of the tunnel?
There's a voice in your head that none of us can control. We would like to turn it off at times, but we can't. And that's, some people refer to it as your soul, as your guiding light, your compass. And if you listen to that, many people refer to it as your gut reaction. I like to think of it as the instinctive, reflective action that you make when presented. There's been studies done on the decision-making process, and I think whistleblowing, like everything else in our life, boils down to making a decision, right? Mm-hmm. And so the four steps in the decision-making process are, you have to identify, and this is all done instantaneously, you identify a dilemma. Oh boy, I see this. I see a wallet of cash on the floor. what am I going to do? The next step is it kicks in with that training and with your predisposed actions and behaviors. I'm going to pick it up and put all the money in my pocket and walk away. Or no, that's not the right thing to do. I'm going to take it to a post office, put it in an envelope, send it back. Instantaneous.
Yeah.
Then you get to the point where you go, well, wait a minute. I really could use that money. And then you start to second guess, but it's already after that voice in your head has told you what to do.
Right.
And then the fourth step is actually the action. And the most difficult thing we have to do, and I even encountered it in the research I was doing, I can pose a question to you. Hey, Nick, you find a wallet on the ground of $5,000 in the wallet, and what would you do? And then the test, you would say, well, the right answer must be give it back. So you write down, you give it back. What would you actually do? And what is the story? What's the baggage you're carrying with you that says maybe there's medical bills or maybe you need the money? And that's all the things that happen instantaneous as that voice in your head, two voices, one saying, yep, put it in your pocket. The other one saying, nope, give it back. And we have to be guided by our conscience and by our soul in terms of making those decisions. And it's not something you can say, I'm going to give that some thought and think about it for a couple of weeks. Instantaneous, it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that baggage ends up kind of clouding so much of it. I don't know. The breakdown happens probably between step 3 and 4 or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you're right. It's like instant. I mean, the mind is bizarre and it's fast. And you run 1,000 permutations and, you know, calculations within literally a fraction of a second. It's nuts.
Yeah, and you think about all the examples, and again, they just bombard me because of the class that I teach at Northwood, Ethical Leadership and Moral Development. And it runs the gamut, you know.
Totally.
5,000 people at Wells Fargo, 5,000 people were part of an incentive plan that paid them very large sums of money for creating accounts, selling new accounts, right? So they're supposed to do it on the phone. It was all supposed to be above board. And what ended up happening is many, many cases of just creating it out of thin air, going through the phone book and writing down a name, saying, here's a new account that people would never even know they had a Wells Fargo account. 5,000 people were part of that. You can't tell me that someone didn't know that that was not the right thing to do.
Yeah,
they went along with it. They were getting paid to go along with it. The Houston Astros, when they were stealing the signs with the cameras and the drums, and they cheated to win the World Series. You can't tell me that the manager and the coach and many other players in the organization didn't know exactly what was going on. Yet no one questioned. Well, I shouldn't say no one because I don't know, but it was never reported that anyone during that time said, whoa, hang on, we can't keep doing this. So just a couple of examples that show how instantaneous those decisions are made and how people fear the fact of either losing money or losing their job or not going along with the status quo can be so overwhelming to some people that they just go their whole life without ever saying anything.
Yeah. So I just wonder, it's such an interesting kind of conundrum, you know, like we have a lot of people in our company that'll speak up and they'll come and they'll tell me, hey, something's not working. And I've thought that it's because we've built a special culture and people feel safe and they know, they believe that they're not going to get retaliated against, or I don't know, maybe this is like an ego thing, but I'm just like, all right, well, we built something that people believe in. But it could actually be that we just either attract people that are more in that other group, or we might just be selecting whistleblowers. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But think about it this way. And let me push it back on you to this extent. How can you take what you have there and that example that you gave and replicate that now into other organizations?
Well, my going theory, at least until this conversation, has been that it is a fear of retaliation. I think that most people hear both of those voices. And because, you know, people have varying sort of hierarchies of values in terms of the extent to which they will prioritize their ability to look themselves in the eye. You know what I'm saying? I think there's sort of a gradation scale there. My theory has been the battleground is on that middle 80%, and that middle 80% probably all see it. And if they knew with beyond a shadow of a doubt that, you know, the wrongdoing wasn't going to result in like a personal cost to them, physical, maybe tangible dollar cost, if you want to boil it down to something, you know, physical, you know, tangible, I guess, then they would speak up. But perhaps there's just a bunch of people who wouldn't speak up. So I'm saying that if you can have a culture of a speak up culture, a true speak up culture where people truly feel safe and the mission is the mission and there's not a person's ego above the mission and the mission, whatever that is one that people believe. I mean, there's no perfect company, of course, and there's no culture that's on the wall, the words on the wall that are actually lived out, just like there's no person who may be pursuing perfection that's ever going to achieve it, but it's still noble to do that and close that gap. I've just thought that if you can get people to believe it, then they're more likely to speak up. And if you can stamp out retaliation and on the one hand, you know, say like, we're not going to stand for retaliation. And then on the other hand, hold up the speak up, you know, the people that do speak up as heroes to like reinforce that thing that says, hey, if there's something going on, this is a safe place for me to tell or for you to tell me. I've thought it's been, you know, replicatable. But I don't know. I don't know.
But think about that 80% real quick again. Most likely they're not at the highest level of the organization, right?
Well, yeah, I think the battleground is at that. Right. It's on the front lines. It's right. Giving a voice to the voiceless. It's the people without power. Those are the right. People that can really crowdsource, that you can crowdsource risk management from if they're actualized and if they feel safe. That's been my going like theory, you know?
With you, you are at the top of the pyramid. And so beginning with you, it permeates its way down through the organization, right? Mm. And so it's very crystal clear. I don't think it was as clear at Enron. I don't think it was as clear at Theranos. I don't think it was as clear of thousands of other examples that you can think of. And the reason is because not only the 80%, but even started as you start making your way up the pyramid, people are reacting to the behaviors and the way that the company is being run by the people who are designated to run that company. And if they're taking cutting corners and doing things that everyone knows shouldn't be done, but who's going to tell the emperor he has no clothes? So it just becomes part of, well, this is just the way we are at Wells Fargo. This is the way we are at Volkswagen. And so you go through this life, this career of just going through the motions. That's pretty sad to me.
It is sad. So maybe it is. Maybe the strong force is tone at the top. I mean, the way we look at it is kind of you're never going to have a strong tree without like a strong root system. And if the root system's corrupt, then all that rot is going to, you know, come up to the branches and all that stuff. Anyway, you look at it, maybe that is truly the strong force. I mean, we kind of have a benefit in the business we're in because it's a corporate integrity business. And I also have a partner in my brother who we are, you know, we look at the world the same way. We have the same foundation and the same, you know, wiring, you know, we're different people, of course, but, so that reinforcement maybe makes it easier for folks to believe it. I don't know. Again, we don't have a perfect company, but I can't imagine that it's not replicatable. I just can't. I refuse to. How's that?
No. Well, I agree with you. It has to be.
It has to be.
As a society, we're not going to survive. One area that we haven't by design talked about is political. And even in all my research, right. I haven't ventured into that area because that's an abyss, and that's a whole separate topic. But it's also it's correlated to everything we've been talking about on a organization or corporate level. But in the big scheme of things, as a society, if we can't if we can't get that straightened out, then there's little hope. Not as much hope as I wish there would be.
So I think we talked about this, but these are directionally right. So the average rate of sociopathy is 3% or something. And then at corporate leadership level, it's call it 5 to 8%. And then at the government level, I just saw a study. It was 11 to 13%. That's orders of, on a bell curve, that's standard deviations. That's orders of magnitude more. So yeah. Think about it from a tone from the top perspective. If all the people running the country, the leaders, have this much, there's this rate of psychopaths or sociopaths or whatever up there, what is the trickle down effect on a country?
Yeah. Yeah. And as we are receiving their messages,
yeah,
what are we receiving?
Exactly.
I'm ethical. Vote for me. I'm going to do this, 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 and this. Trust me. And just like some of the corporate leaders, as they're saying that, as Bernie Madoff was taking money from clients who are saying, well, is this going to be invested in good stocks and fun?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And I'll take that check for $5 million. He left the room knowing that that was never going to be invested in any kind of stock whatsoever. And the same thing with the politicians. The minute they get done talking, in many cases, they know that everything they just said was a facade. And yet that's the whole premise for the society, many parts of society that we're in today.
Man, oh man. Well, this was fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. I feel like we could have talked for another hour.
I do too. And just the one thing I'll leave you with is, and I leave even the students and other talks that I give, and that is this: where do we go from here?
Yeah.
What can we do? I mean, okay, here's my story. Here's what happened. Here's other stories. Here's what happened. But so what? What does that mean tomorrow?
What?
Yeah. What does it mean tomorrow? What's it mean next week? What's it mean for companies that are listening and say, yeah, well, I want to do something? There is a way to create a strategy, to create an ethical learning organization, to create the things that are necessary that provide the individuals the confidence to know that they can come in and do work that they're passionate about without fear of the politics and fear of being retaliated and someone saying that you did something wrong when you really didn't. So I'm devoted to paying it forward in some way, shape, or form. And I think your organization and what you do is a great example of what we need to help organizations get to that next level. And I would offer any help that I could provide you or others going forward, count me in, because this is a topic that I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, I can tell. Well, thanks for those kind words. Thanks again for coming on The Ethics Experts. This was really a blast, really a fun episode. And, it's nice to talk to a whistleblower who's sort of come out the other side and has, that says, I don't regret it. And that there's life after whistleblowing. And the life the life I'm living now is in the promised land. It's not in this wilderness of sort of ethical gray or compromise or any of that kind of stuff. So thank you so much. Until next time.
Thanks a lot, Nick. Bye-bye.